Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing concern that a new Cold War could be brewing between the US and Russia, and speak with Nina Krusheva, a professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She joins us to discuss Russia's military escalation in Syria with a flotilla of warships, including an aircraft carrier, showing the flag as they enter the Mediterranean today on their way to Syria. We'll also look into the concerns that Hillary Clinton's call for a no-fly zone in Syria could lead to a military confrontation, and assess the possibility that although the Kremlin seems to have hoped for a Trump victory, a new reset of the tense and tattered relationship between the former Cold War adversaries could happen with a new Hillary Clinton administration starting with a blank slate. Then we'll speak with Ambassador David Sheffer, a lawyer and diplomat who served as the first United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues during the Bill Clinton administration. He led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court that three African nations are now abandoning, with Burundi, then South Africa, and now Gambia withdrawing from the ICC. We will discuss the charge by Gambia's information minister that the ICC is, quote, an international Caucasian court, since all of the arrest warrants issued since 2004 are for 39 individuals, all of whom are Africans. We will also discuss why the U.S. has not joined the ICC and why Middle Eastern and Asian war criminals have so far not been indicted. Then finally, we will speak with Justin Vogt, a senior editor at Foreign Affairs, about the latest issue of Foreign Affairs that deals with the power of populism, with wide-ranging analyses of the rising populist movements on the left and the right emerging around the world as traditional duopolies in Europe between the socialists and conservatives fray, and in the United States, the Republican-Democrat duopoly is challenged on the left by Bernie Sanders and on the right by Donald Trump. We will explore the extent to which growing inequality is the result of neoliberal economics and globalism and the cause of the rejection of elites around the world. And joining us now is Nina Krusheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. Her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, and she has an article at the Gulf Times, When Referendums Undermine Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Krusheva.
Thank you.
And there's a certain amount of hand-wringing going on in international policy and foreign policy circles about the possibility of a new Cold War between Russia and the West, questions being asked, what went wrong? I'm getting mail to that effect as well. Meanwhile, of course, this Russian flotilla went down the English Channel, letting Britannia know that Britannia doesn't necessarily no longer rules the waves. And today, the flotilla with the aircraft carrier entered the Mediterranean through the Straits of Gibraltar on their way to Syria, where Vladimir Putin appears to be doubling down in terms of military assets. So what's the state of play there, given that Secretary of State John Kerry has endless, fruitless meetings with Lavrov, his counterpart, and meanwhile, it does look like Russia is changing facts on the ground, while to the eyes of many in the United States, in particular Donald Trump and the Republicans, America is showing signs of weakness and vacillation.
Well, I think that what Vladimir Putin is doing, he's trying, I mean, as you said, doubling down, trying to really bring it to everybody's attention that the United States is weak, as it's indecisive, it's no longer the leader, and therefore he supposedly goes in because he's the only one who makes decisions, knows how to save the world, help democracy, because that's another argument that Russians are using, is that since Assad, Bashar al-Assad was an elected leader, you know, America has no power to take him out, take him down. And this is one of the major aspects of Putin's policy in Syria when he says that America is supposedly leader of the free world and supposedly is legal and democratic, and yet look what they're doing. So he's pursuing a couple of directions here. One is undermine American image, which now actually he has audience for because the image has indeed been not as strong as it once was, but also really putting his foot in the Middle East where Russia really didn't have any leverage for quite a bit of time. So Syria is the place where he has an opportunity to show that Russia has an opportunity to have some influence, and moreover, Russia does have a fleet there. Russia also, another part of it is that this new equipment, military equipment, and military forces and machinery. It's all new, and basically, Syria has become a ground test for Russia's preparations or possible preparations for war and defense.
So when Hillary Clinton in the last debate talked about a no-fly zone, that alarmed a lot of people because of the possibility, even though, of course, she's not president yet, of the U.S. And Russia clashing. They do have a deconfliction arrangement vis-a-vis airspace. But, by the way, does anybody believe that Assad was democratically elected? I mean, I remember back in 2011, the Syrian people rose up against him after Gaddafi had fallen. They were emboldened and he shot them down in the streets. So it's an odd kind of construct that he's the Democrat.
Well, the Gaddafi story was a very mute one because Gaddafi was, in fact, you know, being killed. Was it at least what we can read all sorts of things on both sides, but Gaddafi was not necessarily prosecuted the way he should have been in a legal environment, and, you know, who knows who shot him in the street and who was pushing the shooting and whatnot. So that actually, the end of Gaddafi really doesn't speak well for democracies. And Putin, one of the arguments that Putin is making is that we don't want the same end in Syria, because fine, you wanted to push out Gaddafi, whoever you were supporting, I mean, the West shot him like a dog, and now look what it's happening in Libya. So we're not going to repeat that. So, and this is actually an argument that many support, because one of the whatever Russia is doing there, and as you know, not to good end, it is a problem that the United States does not have an exit strategy and really hasn't offered anything to make sure that Putin's own policies are being confronted and Syrian people are benefiting from them. Sure. And I think that is a problem. The reason that Putin is able to do things in Syria stems from the fact that the United States does not have a policy.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Of course, nobody wants Somalia on the Mediterranean. But on the other hand, a lot of the world, including the United Nations, are appalled at what they call barbarism in terms of Russia's and Syria's bombing of civilians in Aleppo. And I think what is most likely to happen, since it looks like at the end of the day, Russia and Assad and the Iranians will win, that there'll be a massive exodus of Sunnis, as there was shortly after Putin first deployed forces in Syria. And that, of course, will impact Europe again, perhaps even more so than it did the first time around. So this is a situation that goes beyond the Middle East.
Absolutely. And I think, and you know, one of the things one should understand, one doesn't have to, but one should understand about Putin is that all these things that he's doing are very tactical. I mean, they're short-term solutions for him staying in power for another 10 years, for bringing Russia to the world stage. But these are not long-term solutions. And I think in every time when, you know, there is a policy proposal of dealing with Russia, one has to think that Russia doesn't think in long terms. And so, yes, you presented a long-term picture, and I think if Putin would think about this, he would probably double try to actually step back and have more forceful conversations with the United States and all those involved. But he doesn't, because for him, the immediate solution is to be president of Syria, to present Russia as a strong state, to stay in the Kremlin for another 10 years, and so on and so forth. And one of the problems of American foreign policy, especially towards Russia, that it is very, as you said at the beginning of this conversation, very Cold War-ish. The idea is Russia is by definition an enemy, and therefore we are going to treat it as such. We are going to, bait Putin at all times and really create a situation in which he would have no chance to turn around and say we are going to partner with the United States, because by the time he can or cannot do that, he would be so thoroughly insulted, and he's an easily insulted man, not as easily as Donald Trump, but still. And so there would be really no opportunity for further conversation.
Well, apparently Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin did have a relationship of sorts. They spoke often on the phone and at length. But that relationship completely collapsed when Obama, mano a mano, with his phone pal, Vladimir Putin, said, hand over Edward Snowden. And Putin refused. And that apparently infuriated Obama. Is there a possibility, and it's a pretty much a defunct relationship, is there a possibility of a clean slate under Hillary Clinton, a new reset?
Could be. I don't know, because I think Obama was incredibly mistaken in his relationship with Russia. It started with Hillary Clinton's reset button in 2009. I mean, they already went it the wrong way because they were talking to the wrong man in Moscow. They talked to the insignificant president, Dmitry Medvedev, versus Vladimir Putin, who was at the time prime minister, but should be the person to be talked to. But anyway, so that was a mistake, and somebody really advised Barack Obama wrongly on that. And with Snowden, too, I mean, you know, Barack Obama shouldn't have asked for Putin to return Snowden. Putin told him he couldn't, and he couldn't, because imagine the same situation in reverse. America would have never given a spy of that sort or an analyst of that sort back to the Russians. So that was not really something that the U.S. played well. So it's too bad that Barack Obama took it personally and got insulted, because it was the time when, in fact, they could have had some sort of relationship, especially in regards to Syria. As you remember, Barack Obama at the time announced the red line with Syrian chemical weapons, and the Russians stepped in. Well, they were asked to step in and help to dechemicalize Syria. I mean, it was a positive outcome at the time. But another thing to remember about Putin, former KGB agent, is that if you look for Putin to solve your problems, then you know that you have to have some sort of an exit strategy from that, because he's going to use it as leverage against you. And so he did. And one of the problems, I think, with Barack Obama's relationship with Putin is that Putin is Putin. He will always be like that. And sort of putting hands on your hips and saying, well, he doesn't behave the right way, it's not going to go anywhere. And I hope that Hillary Clinton be a better judge of sort of Russian relationship, because she should be, and she was a Secretary of State, although with a failed reset nonetheless. But at the same time, she already insulted him enough. I mean, insulted Putin enough, calling him Hitler, using him as a punching bag in the elections conversations because of, you know, the Cold War ease of, you know, turning Russia into an enemy, not that it wasn't one. And so I don't really know whether there is enough room to go back in that relationship. Right. I hope there is, because Putin doesn't want the world disorder he wants to be part of the world order. He doesn't want the world disorder because that makes the world very, very messy. Not that he will not try not to dominate the conversation. He would, but, you know, for example, the nuclear disaster that may happen if Donald Trump is elected and they both decide that they don't like each other because they both want to be the top dog in the game, and you know, both already said that they can use nuclear power as a way out of conflicts and conversations. That I don't think Putin is looking forward to. So I still think that Hillary Clinton would be, to some degree, a person that he can deal with, and they can discuss the world rather than blow it up together.
Just in the last minute, then, on the one hand, Putin has told the Russian people that the world is against you and that the West is closing in on you. And it's true that an eastward expansion of NATO has been, I think, unnecessarily and counterproductive. So what is it? Is it a case of, is there any way for the West to stop at NATO expansion and to reach out across Putin and say, to the Russian people, we're not out to get you, we just don't like your leader and the extent to which he's stealing you blind?
Well, I don't think there's a viable solutions now because NATO has expanded. Ukraine is having exercises with NATO, so that's certainly something that Ukraine is not going to give up and Putin is not going to accept, the West can tell the Russians that Putin is robbing you blind and that Kremlin is the most corrupt Kremlin that you've ever seen, which is probably true. Actually, it is true. It's not good. Whatever the West is going to say to the Russians is no longer going to register. It's almost, just imagine it's like Hillary Clinton's campaign addressing the hardened Trump supporters. Whatever Hillary Clinton says, by definition, it comes from the source that you are not going to believe. And therefore, whatever the West says to the Russians now is coming from the source that you are not going to believe. So if Putin is to go, I think the only way he can go if he is taken out by his own people. I mean, his own elites, his own, you know, the surrounding, sure, surrounding entourage. Or, since he's planning to be there for 10 years, if not more, you know, something may happen and, you know, people suddenly get so hungry because of the Western sanctions and so disillusioned in say, war with Ukraine or war in Syria, that they would go to the streets. But I would not really count on it.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, and her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, and she has an article at the Gulf Times, When Referendums Undermine Democracy. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the U.S. diplomat who led the U.S. delegation in talks establishing the International Criminal Court. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Sheffer, who's a lawyer and diplomat who served as the first United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues during President Clinton's second term. He also led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court and currently teaches international criminal law and international human rights law at Northwestern University School of Law, where he directs the Center for International Human Rights. His award-winning book, All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals, recounts the building of the tribunals in the 1990s from Ambassador Sheffer's inside perspective. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Sheffer.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And the latest country to pull out of the International Criminal Court is the West African nation of Gambia. Its information minister called the International Criminal Court an international Caucasian court and complained that the ICC didn't indict former British Prime Minister Tony Blair over the Iraq war. I guess the point that the – and, of course, it's worth noting that Burundi was the first country to announce it intended to depart. That was back in October the 7th, and South Africa subsequently announced it would also leave the court. So does this have something to do with that since the International Criminal Court started issuing arrest warrants in 2005, it's indicted 39 people, all of them African?
Yes, well, that is certainly a predicate to the actions that have been taken within the last week and a half by Burundi, which is moving towards a notice of withdrawal. South Africa, which has already delivered a notice of withdrawal, and now Gambia's initiative today. It should be noted that nobody has literally withdrawn from the court yet. It takes 1 year before any such notice is effective. So these countries are all still part of the court. But yes, the rationale has many dimensions to it. The first is a sense of, shall we say, sort of legal imperialism with respect to Africa, that the court has focused so heavily on Africa. But, you know, it just needs to be said right out front that what has taken place with respect to the International Criminal Court in Africa has not been literally at the initiative of the court itself. It is because of the initiative of the Security Council that has referred Libya and Darfur to the court. It has been at the initiative of the African countries themselves, which have, as we call, self-referred their situations to the court. That's where the bulk of these indictments are from, is self-referrals. The only situation in Africa that has been at the initiative of the ICC prosecutor, first Moreno Ocampo of Argentina, and then now Fatou Bensouda of the Gambia, is Kenya and the electoral violence that took place there in 2007-2008. The evidence was presented to the prosecutor, and then she received, and he received, and then she has followed through on actions that have been approved by the judges. They can't act without the approval of the judges, who also come from Africa. So it should, you know, the perspective here is that we need to sort of dig down a little bit deeper, Ian, as to, given all of that, why would Africa still be, or why would certain African nations still be taking these initiatives?
Well, indeed, Uganda's president, Museveni, he has condemned the court rather vitriolically. But, of course, ironically, he also asked the court to investigate abuses by the Lord's Resistance Army in 2003. So
precisely,
there is obviously some, and of course, there's no question that the people that are indicted deserve to be indicted. But we clearly got a sense of how it wasn't working when Omar Bashir, the Sudanese leader, went to a conference, an international African conference down in South Africa, and a judge there issued an arrest warrant, and Jacob Zuma made sure that Omar Bashir got on a plane and got out of town. So It's probably not an entirely surprise, is it, that Jacob Zuma has taken this position. What do you think? Is there a personal subtext there? Because he's under a lot of pressure at home in South Africa in terms of corruption inquiries.
Exactly. And there does seem to be an attitude that has been taken by Mr. Kenyatta in Kenya, by now Mr. Museveni in Uganda, and we see it now in South Africa, of individual leaders who have had difficult, shall we say, experiences with the rule of law, both domestically and under international law, and they are seeking to shield themselves from scrutiny. Now, normally, let me just say that those countries that are not party to the International Criminal Court can very clearly state the argument that their leaders have what we call in international law head of state immunity for the time that they are in office. And that is a very important and central rule of international law, that leaders need to be able to function in very problematic political landscapes without threat of legal action because of the political decisions that they're making as heads of state. So that's a very important rule. The problem here is that these countries have ratified the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which denies them that rule of international law with respect to the heads of state of the countries which have ratified the Rome Statute, and there are 124 of them, 34 of them being in Africa. That clash between a treaty commitment, a treaty obligation to bring leaders to justice for atrocity crimes, runs up in their minds against head of state immunity. But the Rome Statute did not somehow preserve head of state immunity for the leaders of the countries that have ratified the convention. That head of state immunity is set aside when it comes to atrocity crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. Now, they still have head of state immunity for other issues like corruption and, you know, political crimes and things of that nature. But when it comes to these core atrocity crimes, which are jus cogens crimes under international law, they signed up and ratified a treaty that says they're putting that protection aside in respect of their own leaders.
Again, I'm speaking with David Sheffer, who's a lawyer and diplomat who served as the first United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues during President Clinton's second term. He also led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court and currently teaches international criminal law and international human rights law at Northwestern University School of Law, where he directs the Center for International Human Rights. His award-winning book, All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals, recounts the building of the tribunal in the 1990s from Ambassador Sheffer's inside perspective. And of course, it's important to note that the United States is not a signatory to the Rome Treaty in creating the International Criminal Court, that President Clinton did work with the ICC, but he did not submit the treaty to the Senate for ratification. Obviously, it wouldn't have been ratified. And then George W. Bush didn't cooperate with the court, but then President Obama has cooperated. Is that a brief history?
Yes, it is, although, you know, President Clinton did authorize the and did follow through with signing the Rome Statute on December 31st, 2000, but with only 3 weeks left in his presidency, there was, of course, no plausible basis for submitting it in those 3 weeks to the Senate for ratification. No treaty gets ratified that quickly. When the George W. Bush administration came on board, they took a rejectionist attitude towards the treaty, and therefore it not only did not go forward to ratification, but they attempted to eviscerate the signature, which happened to be my signature because I was the one who signed the Rome Statute, with a letter to the Secretary General of the UN saying they're not going to undertake any of the responsibilities of a signatory state, which just means you don't try to undermine the treaty if you signed it but not ratified it. They then sought in many different ways to then undermine the treaty. So we are still, however, a signatory to the Rome Statute. It's just that we have this caveat to our signature that says we don't have to, you know, follow the rules of being a signatory state. I would think I would really like it the case to unfold, frankly, that President Obama in his final months in office would simply send another letter to the Secretary General saying we restore our signatory status. We're not going to seek to undermine the treaty, but of course we're not ready yet to ratify it. Now, the fact that the United States has not ratified the treaty is a very, very important issue, one that deserves a lot of discussion, Ian. But I think in the Africa context, it does raise the double standard issue, whereby African leaders say, don't lecture us about complying with the Rome Statute if you, the United States, if you, Russia, if you, China, if you, Indonesia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, if all of those countries have not ratified the Rome Statute, then do not lecture us about it. So that's sort of the crux we find ourselves in. You know, the United States can be a leader. It has been in so many ways in international criminal justice since Nuremberg, but it cannot sustain that leadership if it stays out of the Rome Statute.
So will there be a snowball effect then, Ambassador Schaeffer, given that these three African countries are pulling out and Duterte, the new leader of the Philippines, is having... He's quite mercurial, made some quite extreme statements, certainly in terms of diplomacy, using words like son of a whore to describe our president, not exactly diplomatic language. He's already furious with the International Criminal Court for rebuking him over the extrajudicial killings in his war on drugs. He looks like a candidate to take a walk, would you think?
He would be a very interesting target for investigation. His country is a state party to the Rome Statute, one of the few Asian countries that is a state party. I think the people of the Philippines were very supportive of that initiative when it was taken. But the extrajudicial killings in Philippines certainly do rise to the attention of the prosecutor. However, let me just suggest that for Africa and the cascade effect, as I've written in the online blog, Just Security, Africa could take African nations could easily take initiatives to broaden the scope of the International Criminal Court's investigations and prosecutions. It does not all have to be in Africa. In fact, the Philippines would be an interesting example. It is possible under the Rome Statute. In fact, it was the preferred methodology when we negotiated the statute in the 1990s, that state parties make referrals to the court. That doesn't mean it's only self-referrals. In fact, we were barely thinking of self-referrals when we negotiated the treaty. What we were thinking of was, for example, a country such as South Africa could easily refer the Philippines to the International Criminal Court, and the prosecutor would be obligated to start a formal investigation of the Philippines. Now, no African nation has ever taken advantage of that right. So why not? I mean, if the complaint is that African states are the only ones being subjected to these formal investigations and prosecutions and indictments, they have it within their power to refer non-African situations to the ICC prosecutor. And it's sort of astonishing that they have not seized that power.
So what is the relationship, though, with the Security Council and the ICC? Because obviously, what's happening in Aleppo now, the UN representative there for human rights has already said, but by the way, this also applies to Yemen as well, that war crimes are being committed. And in the case, yep, of Yemen by Saudi Arabia, and in the case of Aleppo by Russia and the Assad regime in Syria, they would seem to be ripe candidates, the Assads, since they've basically been killing their own people, up, you know, between quarter of a million and half a million so far. So, but because of Russia has vetoed constantly any efforts to either bring about humanitarian relief or indict the Assad regime, is that, in other words, you have to get around the veto problem with the Security Council, do you, in terms of getting an ICC indictment?
That's correct. You'd have to have the agreement or abstention of any or and all of the five permanent members, the United States, United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China, in order to advance a referral to the International Criminal Court under Chapter 7 authority of the UN Charter, which is the enforcement authority. That's how you refer a matter by the Security Council to the ICC. Libya and Darfur were the two referrals in the past. But Russia has been, of course, in its alignment with the Assad regime in Syria, has blocked any such referrals. But, you know, what I have argued is, yes, that's a reality, but the African countries could use their diplomatic clout far more effectively in pressing Russia and China to let these referrals go through, or even with respect to Yemen, pressing perhaps the United States and the United Kingdom and France to let a referral go through on the Yemen situation, which, of course, would shine a very sharp light on the Saudi military, but also the Yemenese militias. So that's one area where Africa, instead of trying to get the Security Council to give them a waiver on investigating them, which is permitted under the Rome Statute, but you have to get the Security Council to agree, and they will not agree to that. The United States, the United Kingdom, France will not accede to that request to sort of give them a free pass on atrocity crimes. But I would say turn that clout around and say, all right, then we're going to hold your feet to the fire, Russia. We want Syria referred to the ICC. We want Yemen referred. We want the Philippines referred. We want Colombia referred. I mean, there are lots of opportunities out there that I think African nations should use their diplomatic clout to actually achieve, and that would greatly diversify the docket before the International Criminal Court.
Well, David Sheffer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Sheffer, who's a lawyer and diplomat who served as the first United States ambassador-at-large for war crimes issues during President Clinton's second term. He also led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court and currently teaches international criminal law and international human rights law at Northwestern University School of Law, where he directs the Center for International Human Rights. His award-winning book, All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals, recounts the building of the tribunals in the 1990s. Is from Ambassador Sheffer's inside perspective. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with a senior editor of Foreign Affairs, whose latest issue deals with the power of populism around the world. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Justin Vogt, who's a senior editor at Foreign Affairs, who previously served as managing editor of World Policy Journal and worked on the editorial staff of The New Yorker and as an associate producer on documentary films for the PBS series Frontline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Vogt.
Thanks, Ian.
And Foreign Affairs has a forthcoming issue, I think, in terms of print. Is it up on the website now, I think?
It's actually on the web, and it's out on newsstands as well.
It's out on newsstands. And basically, the whole edition is devoted to populism.
And most of it, yes, that's right.
Right. So I've been trying to follow this as well, of course. Recently, speaking with John Judas, who has a new book out called The Populist Explosion, but it is an extraordinary phenomenon in terms of the way that certainly in Europe and the United States, the traditional duopolies in Europe between the socialists and the conservatives, and here in the United States between the Republicans and Democrats, appear to be breaking down. Some people think that a Trump defeat could well mean the Republican Party itself breaking up. So in the course of putting this together for this new issue of Foreign Affairs, is there any single kind of explanation for this tectonic shift in traditional political power structures, both in Europe and the United States?
I think there are many possible explanations. I think one of the strongest ones, and it's the one articulated in this package of articles by Fareed Zakaria, points to a kind of convergence between the duopoly, as you put it, on the left and right, amongst mainstream parties. Cass Mutta, who also wrote an article for this package on Europe, makes a very similar point. That is that the duopoly is breaking down, but only after a long period of decades, really, where the traditional establishment parties on the left and the right both started to drift towards a kind of technocratic pro-globalization center, which left giant vacuums on both the left and the right, which were essentially waiting to be filled. And I think you can say the catalyst for that, for those vacuums being filled on both sides of the aisle by populists, was the financial crisis of 2007-2008. That's the sort of short answer. There's a more interesting long answer, and I'll give a sort of short version of the long answer. It's mostly what Fareed Zakaria has laid out in this piece, which is a really good overview of this for people who are interested in it. You have to look at four sort of factors here that have changed the economies and politics of countries in Europe and U.S. in the past few decades. And their demographic change is the first one, right, which is that fertility rates have dropped. And this is something that people don't talk about too often. It doesn't seem salient necessarily to political conversations, but it is, because it means that you have smaller workforces, you have a lot more retirees. It puts a constraint on what countries can do. When countries' populations are growing, it's a different story, at least in developed countries. The second one is globalization, right? And this is a kind of common explanation. With globalization of the economy, you've had a lot more competition for labor, more competition for capital, and this has led people to be kind of left behind, especially those who worked in manufacturing or the trades. Related to that is technological change, technological development, which, you know, has had a similar impact and created inequalities. Even as it has created progress economically, it has led to the fruits of that progress being, distributed unequally. And all of this has kind of produced these two effects. One is a kind of political gridlock when there aren't that many options because of these constraints. And the second is a convergence between left and right on a kind of sensible, incrementalist, pro-free market center, which, you know, produced a lot of frustration amongst voters who might want more dramatic solutions or maybe even a more bold, decisive, sort of strong man who could lead them. And I think, you know, in the U.S. and elsewhere, that's what we're starting to see.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Vogt, who's a senior editor at Foreign Affairs, who previously served as a managing editor of World Policy Journal and worked on the editorial staff of The New Yorker and as an associate producer on documentary films for the PBS series Frontline. And we're talking about the new issue of Foreign Affairs magazine that has a number of articles on the subject of the power of populism, a global phenomenon that we're discussing. Now, when there was a recent study by Oxfam of the global inequality in wealth. We talk a lot about it here in the United States, of course, and it became a campaign issue, particularly when Bernie Sanders was running for president. And it will continue to be, of course. But the extraordinary thing about the Oxfam study was that 85 families control half of the globe's wealth. So what, I mean, little wonder there's a restiveness, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's an incredible statistic. It's just an astonishing figure. It just harkens back. You think of that coming from something like the Gilded Age. We're living in a new Gilded Age, as that statistic demonstrates. You're right. This shouldn't have been a surprise in some ways, although I think the ways in which it's manifesting are sometimes surprising or even shocking. I would say that the flip side of that argument, though, which is made frequently, is that inequality has grown within countries, especially developed countries, but also developing economies. But let's also remember that at the same time, the inequality between the global rich, maybe putting aside those 85 families, and the global have-nots, has shrunk dramatically, especially with the incredible growth in China and Asia and other parts of the world, which have really seen the kind of economic strides in recent decades that we associate with an earlier era of Western development. And that actually, though, has also led to this populist explosion, as Judith calls it, in a very particular way. You've had an incredible surge of rising expectations all over the world. And it's important to note that this populist explosion or this populist moment isn't really just limited to Europe and the United States. You can find elements of it in other political systems. Look just at the Philippines, which has been in the headlines in the past few days, which elected a populist kind of strongman leader in Duterte, and who has been really shaking up things up with some statements about the country's relationship to the United States, which break with tradition. You can see it even in a place like India, where you now have a Hindu nationalist right-wing president for the past few years, who, although is has a kind of technocratic image of an economic reformer, has relied, this is Prime Minister Modi I'm speaking of here, has relied throughout his career on a very populist appeal to Hindu nationalism, which sort of says, you know, there's the people and then there's the kind of everybody else, in this case, Muslims. So, you know, you're certainly right to say that that this kind of the fact that inequality has become such a pressing matter should have tipped more people off to the fact that the kind of changes we're seeing now were likely. But I do think it's also important to note that it's not because people are suddenly bereft or are in, you know, economic despair. Far from it. In fact, in some ways, the improvement improvement and the increased opportunities for many people over the world has led to rising expectations, which have been very difficult to meet. And I think that is what we're really seeing, both in the West and elsewhere, in this kind of anger and rage. We're seeing a kind of sense of unmet expectations and dissatisfaction after a period when many people thought that, you know, the sky was the limit.
But in terms of the people that have contributed to this new issue of Foreign Affairs that's out now, you've got, as you mentioned, Fareed Zakarias has contributed. Also, Stuart Reed did an interview with Marine Le Pen that I also wanted to talk to you about. Michael Kazin, I hosted him recently at a forum that I moderate at UCLA on populism, Sherry Berman, Cass Mudd that you mentioned as well. So but just to finish up on this issue of what I'm interested in, is there an analysis of the mechanism that drives this global phenomenon of the concentration of wealth into fewer and fewer hands?
Well, sure. There are many explanations for, and people point to different mechanisms for that. We actually took a look at that about a year ago. We did a package like this one, not on populism, but on inequality. What causes it? Why it's important, and what you can do about it, if anything. Again, a lot of the same factors you can point to: technological change, globalization. You know, forces that have, in a lot of ways, lifted all boats, but that have lifted some boats a lot higher than others. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And that has created an incredible amount of resentment. You know, but it's an interesting distinction to be made here, I think, between today's the inequality that exists today and what existed in earlier eras. And Sherry Berman in her piece talks about this a little bit, obliquely at least, in that, you know, when you look at today's populist explosion or populist moment, a lot of people, especially on the left, have become worried that what we're really seeing is a kind of proto-fascism, right? That this is, if you listen to the far-right parties in Europe, even if you listen to Trump and at some of his rallies, there's a kind of whiff of something deeply anti-democratic, and this has scared a lot of people. And it's, you know, you've probably seen the articles in the paper recently about at least in coastal elites in the United States running to their therapists and analysts because they're, you know, they're nervous about the election.
Right.
I think that what Sherry Berman's piece really points out, and it's very valuable and it's a little bit reassuring too, is there are two very big differences here between today and the populist moment we're seeing today and the earlier kind of populism of the 20s and 30s, which ultimately produced fascism. And that is that as sort of, you know, nationalistic and perhaps even racialist or racist or sort of extreme as some of the right-wing populists that we see today are, none of them is really calling for to do away with democracy. Right, they're saying kind of in vague ways that they are, you know, going to make a better state, a better system, more effective government. But none of them are doing what, you know, the Mussolinis and the Hitlers did, who, you know, may have come to power through democratic means, but were explicitly offering an alternative to democracy, which was seen to have failed in the interwar period. So this is an important thing, but even more important, maybe, and this gets back to your question about inequality, which is the conditions today are so different than they were then. And we often forget this. And we rightly focus on the problems that exist in today's world and on inequality, which is a really important topic. But you can take that analysis a little too far, and if you fail to see just how much progress has been made. And to compare today to the 20s and 30s, just in terms of material well-being, there's no comparison to be made. And in terms of government dysfunction, there's no comparison to be made. Today's democracies, we've now had decades and decades of democratic rule and the kind of growth of liberal norms and a liberal world order since the end of the Cold War, which is pretty, I think at least, and I think the people that you'll read in Foreign Affairs, and certainly Sherry Berman, thinks is pretty durable and, you know, has gotten through a lot. And we shouldn't kind of worry too much that it's really vulnerable. Again, it's a question of perspective, and the anger that we're seeing today is really reflects not just inequality and not just differences in wealth and opportunity, but the very economic progress which has allowed people, and technological progress which has allowed people, to dream bigger and to see just what people on other sides of the world and in other classes and in other places have. And, you know, in a way that wasn't possible before. And that has fueled, again, a lot of resentment and anger. But what it hasn't fueled, at least in Europe and the U.S., is a real genuine call to basically do away with democratic institutions and values and to just go for something far more extreme. We haven't seen that yet, and hopefully we won't.
Well, but let me just push back on it a little bit, because my sense when you talk about proto-fascism is that a lot of the analysis I've been hearing lately from people I've interviewed about what's happening in Syria and Europe with the rise of Le Pen and Orban in Hungary and the connections to Vladimir Putin basically come down to, oh, Putin is just meddling, causing mischief. But I think there's more to that. And in fact, there's a much more cynical possibility here that Putin's managed democracy, as he calls it, in effect has the best of both worlds. He has autocratic control, but the patina of democracy in this transparent world, you have to sort of manage that. And he does. And that I think the links between Le Pen, Orban, and Putin are to do with their ideological. It's a revival, if you will, of an anti-democratic movement.
I think that's a good argument, and I think, look, you could say that about Orban and Putin, and others have said it about perhaps Trump and Putin. I mean, it may extend beyond Europe now. But here's how I would respond to that. Do you think Putin is operating from a position of strength or a position of weakness? I would say that a lot of what Putin has done, be it the seizure of Crimea, the involvement in Syria, and even what you talked about, his kind of attempt to inject, an anti-Brussels, anti-liberal or illiberal strain of political thinking into Western Europe, have not been, the result of operating from a position of strength, more like desperation. Russia, and if you think about where Putin stands at home, he is really constantly concerned ever since the really incredible explosions of dissent and protest that took place in Moscow and outside of Moscow in 2010 and 11, with maintaining control domestically. That is just not the case for the established parties or the governments in the West that he's trying perhaps to undermine. No similar threat to their rule exists. They may face dissent and populists rising, but the fundamental institutions that they run aren't anywhere close to as imperiled as Putin's is, and I really do think that is important to know, because there is this image of Putin that has grown as this kind of you put it as having the best of both worlds, or kind of managing things so well, or he's some sort of strategic genius. I think that really misses the fact that I don't think Putin feels that way at all. I think he often feels he's just one step ahead of a wave in Russia that is coming for him.
Well, he does have 82% approval, if we're to believe that. And I don't think any Western leader has anything remotely like that. But I agree with you. And the overriding reality is, of course, that the Russian GDP is somewhere between Italy's and Canada's. So,
and is the subject of sanctions that are only getting worse and worse. You're absolutely right that he does have a lot of popular support. I actually wouldn't be surprised if that figure was right. I just think that a lot of that support is predicated on exactly the kinds of illusions that he is, these kind of diversions into foreign matters that are meant to distract attention from the fact that the price of oil has plummeted. And that's the Russian economy is taking a huge hit because of that. And the sanctions, are in fact pretty punishing and are having a real effect and will continue to have effect. And there's really sort of no way around those two things.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Justin Vogt.
Thank you so much, Ian. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Justin Vogt, who's a senior editor at Foreign Affairs, who previously served as managing editor of World Policy Journal and worked on the editorial staff of The New Yorker and as an associate producer on documentary films for the PBS series Frontline. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.